Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And I have a very special guest today. Here I have Michael Anthony, who is executive chef and partner of New American restaurant Gramercy Tavern, an executive chef and director of Untitled, and the studio cafe at the new Whitney Museum of American Art. And Mike received the James Beard Award Best Chef New York City in 2012, and its national recognition, Outstanding Chef, in 2015. And Mike actually started his culinary career in Japan, so today we'll explore how it all started and his love for Japanese cuisine. Hello, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you're from Cincinnati, Ohio, and at college you majored in business and French and minored in Japanese. So why French and Japanese?
Well, languages come easy for me. I think it's a little bit about how you learn. And for me, retracing my steps to childhood of really just kind of being passionate about learning a new culture, the notion of being desperate to learn, you know, moving to those places is the most convincing way to learn the language. But these are things that came easy. As you grow up, you learn a little bit about yourself and how you learn and how you discover the world. And I was passionate about languages. I am not always confident about the ideas that I have to share, but I love being able to share them to lots of people. Mm. So it was really one of my passions from early on. I was lucky enough to travel to France as part of my undergraduate degree, and I was actually at the end of a year of study there. I was taking a bike trip across France. I had a backpack and a tent and a mountain bike, and I was on my way around the peninsula of Brittany, so starting from the north coast and cutting across the end of Brittany and all the way down through those little rocky villages along the Sud Finistère, it's called, the south coast of France. And it's really cool traveling alone because you are, it's inevitable that you'll meet people when you're out there. You're kind of lonely. And so for 5 days, I ended up following these two Japanese guys. Mm. And we just hit it off. We had a blast out on the road, sleeping, you know, in on beaches and discovering France, seeing France also through the eyes of other foreigners who looked at it also differently from their own lens. And I was already curious in the Japanese culture. I didn't know too much about it. But meeting these guys just like made me feel like, wow, you know what? One day I want to check that out.
Oh, wow. So that encounter with that two cyclists changed your whole life, maybe.
It was a little random, but, you know, it stuck with me. And, you know, when I decided to move to Japan, like the day after I graduated from college, I think I might have moved there for all the wrong reasons. I kind of had this like very superficial notion of the Japanese culture being, you know, so mysterious and romantic. And then I moved to Tokyo, which was such a dense and oppressive city. And it was a bit of an eye-opening experience. I realized that, it wasn't simply an ancient culture filled with you know, beautiful things that we see from the outside. They were there, but it was real life and real people. And I noticed that I had a hard time with just simply adapting to my apartment, which had no furniture. And I wasn't used to being on a crowded subway train and having no one, literally no one, cast their gaze my way. In Paris, people stare at each other all the time. In Tokyo, you just don't look up. I guess that's the same way in New York, but that's half out of fear. not just risk. Politeness, right? Right. So yeah, it was an eye-opening experience.
Right. And then I heard that you got interested in the local food scene and worked in the bakery and the farm.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes loneliness pushes you in interesting directions. And I was a long way away from friends and family. But
you went there and then you had a job or you had a...
Well, I had lined up a job teaching English like a lot of people do to experience a new culture or, you know, to work. And it was a well-paying job in a very credible company. I had housing organized and work papers, but the workload was quite easy. I enjoyed teaching. My parents are both teachers, and I enjoyed the idea of... I was actually toying with the idea of becoming a teacher. I had no idea what really I would do with my life at that point. I had literally just walked out of my undergraduate degree and kind of in a place that I really loved, Bloomington, Indiana, but still Bloomington is a bit of an oasis in the Midwest. And so, you know, I was intent on exploring the world and I had in my head this notion of, you know, falling in love with cooking and the idea of becoming a cook. But after having lived in France for a year, I thought I had missed the boat. You know, many people had told me, well, look, you know, you've already gone to college. You didn't grow up in a restaurant family. You didn't start cooking at 14 or 15 years old. Like, it's too late, buddy. And I unfortunately believe that. I kind of, I accepted it. And so when I was living in Japan, I started trading English lessons for cooking lessons. And these were home cooking lessons. And it was just a way to see behind the wall of what it's like to live in Japan. And I became friendly with a group of people that lived in my neighborhood. I didn't really have enough money to live in Tokyo, so I lived just north of the city in Saitama. I lived in Koshigaya City.
Right, it's like an hour and a half maybe by train.
Yeah, it's a long, long commute.
Right.
In fact, I was so proud of, as soon as I arrived, I had learned, this was to date the longest word I knew in Japanese, Tobutsu Koen.
That's the name of a
zoo. That's the zoo. And the only way I knew that is because it was the last stop on my train, because once you leave the outer ring of Tokyo, the words are no longer written in Romanized characters. So I had to, at first I just memorized the number of stops so I got off at the right place. But yeah, I was very proud of that. So anyway, I started exploring and I met a guy who owned a bakery in my little town, and I went in and asked him if I could start working early in the morning, if he'd show me a few things. And, in the back of my mind, I had this idea that, you know what? Maybe I could make a go of this. Maybe, you know, I'm here. I love Japan. I'd like to go to Tsuji Cooking School in Osaka.
CIA of the Japanese. Yeah,
exactly. Beautiful cooking school and so organized. And they've produced so many beautiful books and documents. And the owner is such an inspired character. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to need some professional experience. And I had worked a little bit in restaurants in high school, college, but never with the intent of doing that for a living. So I would get up, you know, at 3:30 in the morning and go in and learn how to make funny things like ampang.
Ampang is the red bean stuffed bread.
And curry pang.
Yeah, the curry stuffed one.
And, you know, for a Westerner, they were really curious breakfast items, but they were also really cool. And I fell in love with them. I really love those things. And so it was more of a just kind of a learning how to be busy than learning the fine craft of baking. But nonetheless, that's part of working in a restaurant. You have to learn the rules. You have to learn the movement. You have to learn the dedication. And, you know, I was more than eager to get up early in the morning like that and work for a few hours, rush home, take a shower, and go do my job.
Wow.
So little by little, the idea of, you know, pursuing cooking stuck. And
so because it's a cultural kind of learning as well, not just food.
Yeah, you know, you have to learn the language, you have to learn the jargon, and you have to learn the timing.
Right.
And there was something about that that made me feel very connected to, you know, I was suffering from feeling disconnected from, you know, from being a foreigner in Japan. And that job made me feel like all of a sudden I have this, you know, this insider's look. And the gentleman who I worked for was very kind. As you can imagine, he worked so hard that he was always tired. His patience was a little short. So it wasn't really like he was holding my hand. He was kind of nipping at my heels. And I would really, I love that pressure of like, hey, like this guy needs me to do this right and get it done, or else I'm messing up his business. And it was just a little mom and pop shop. They lived above. Right. And they invited me into their home, and I started to see how they lived. They were very kind. And then so I took the initiative to reach out in a letter to the culinary critic of the Herald, International Herald Tribune in Tokyo, the English newspaper. And his name is Clint Hall. If he's listening out there, Clint, I just want to give you a big thank you. But I reached out to Clint, not having ever met him.
Oh, really?
And I didn't know him at all. I just read his column in the paper and thought it was cool. And I enjoyed his point of view. And he was very enthusiastic about restaurants. I love when food writers share a sense of love for the restaurant business. They share insight and an infatuation with learning more and giving that to their readers, rather than the notion of walking in and seeing how they can, I gotcha. Pick a restaurant apart. Mm-hmm. So Clint was one of these guys that just shared a love of restaurants. And when I explained my master plan, he didn't laugh. He didn't blow me off. He said, you know, that's cool. Let me introduce you to someone who might be able to help. And that's...
Okay.
That's when
so that master plan was to work for a female chef, Shizuyo Shima. It was a small French bistro called Bistro Shima in Roppongi, Tokyo. So you contacted her?
Yeah, well, fortunately, Clint reached out and made the first contact, because otherwise, I think she probably would have, like, I don't know. I'm not sure she would have answered the phone or answered a letter. She was tough. Shima Sensei was an unbelievable story. I mean, she opened her... She had worked in France for 3.5 years during the mid-70s, you know, way before that wave of Japanese chefs made their way there.
Amazing.
She had worked in a famous 3-Michelin-star restaurant called Le Camellia, which is it's not really even recognized in the current lexicon of famous restaurants that chefs, you know, throw around.
Right.
Obviously, it's no longer there, and the chef owner has since passed away.
That's the Jean de Levin.
Yeah.
And the 3-star Michelin in Paris.
He was the kind of big daddy of that former generation of chefs. Very hard on his employees, I'm sure on himself. It was an infamous restaurant.
Wow. So, yeah, at that time, I can't believe that woman, strong woman. So she had a small restaurant, and it was 18 seats only. And what kind of restaurant was a very serious place?
Well, it was a charming place. In a way, she was translating kind of the culmination of her life, having fallen in love with France and being a cook. She, you know, having lived there and done something that very few people had accomplished, she really was translating that through basically 20-seat restaurant. And it's ironic that, you know, now we fast forward all these years and we look at like all of these chefs in France in particular, but really all over the world, opening restaurants that are minuscule in size and giving that sense of I'm translating my personal point of view of the world in this meal.
Right.
And so that's what she did. She was so far ahead of her time. And it was, you know, it was Tokyo as well, where small restaurants are not necessarily out of place.
Right. The majority, like 20 seats tempura place and 13 seats at tonkatsu place, that kind of mindset.
Right, yeah.
But
and this was ironically, it was about, I don't know, 30 steps away from Roppongi Crossing, the same distance from what is now Roppongi Hills.
Oh, wow.
Or sorry, Roppongi Midtown.
Okay, so that's like a huge business and restaurant shop complex.
Where we actually have a restaurant, wow. Union Square, Tokyo.
Wow.
It's like a seven iron away from that original place. As I remember it, it was a dark and lonely walk from the subway all the way over there. But, you know, listen, there's not a day that goes by that I don't either make reference to something I learned in my first year and a half of working for her, or that I don't, you know, think about in, you know, something related to that very first year. She taught me to, you know, some basics like choose the right tool for the right job. Always work in a clean and organized manner. Always be thinking three steps ahead. And those are the keys, you know, for any cook to succeed in almost any kitchen. So I really, it was a difficult apprenticeship, and I can talk about it lovingly now. I didn't know I would survive the experience then.
But you did.
Yeah.
Right. But eventually, she suggested that you go to France and to formally study French cuisine.
Well, when a year and a half was up, she said, okay, that's it. I've taught you everything I know. It's time for you to move on. And I was like, I was kind of hurt. I was like, are you kicking me out? And she's like, no, that's it. I mean, you've done everything that you can here. It's time for you to learn more. And I said, okay, great. Wow. I did it. And she says, you're going to Paris. And I was like, wait, that's not the plan. And she says, yes, it is. You're going to Paris. You're from the West. If you love Japan so much, you can come back. And that, you know what? I mean, you don't mess around with Shima. I followed her orders. And so I wrote and I applied for school at, you know, in Paris.
Right. And then that was 1992. And you had a lot of great restaurants you worked at. And that's the Camellia as well?
Well, that restaurant had closed by then, but Monsieur de la Vigne was in the kind of last years of his career. And Shima had come and right off the bat in the fall, as soon as I got set up in school, she invited me to lunch at his restaurant in La Rue Saint-Dominique. And it was a small place, and she told, you know, Monsieur de la Vigne that I would be a serious student. I wouldn't mess around. And, you know, would it be okay if I came in to learn the ropes? And he actually allowed me to come into the kitchen 3 days a week after cooking school. So I would pack up my stuff and hightail it across town and go in and just kind of try to stay out of the way. I noticed that the sous chef was wearing soccer shin pads. And I was like, that's curious. Why is he wearing? Maybe they played soccer this afternoon. Well, that is not exactly why he was wearing shoes.
Wow.
So it was a rough place, and you can believe it was an eye-opening experience for me.
Wow. It's shocking. Okay. And so that's when you really learned French techniques and cuisine. But, you know, that was a time, like you said earlier, there was a time many Japanese cooks started to go to France and train. So did you work with them in the kitchen?
I met a lot of Japanese cooks. And, you know, at that time, I was so impressed. First of all, I was deeply in love with the idea of living in Japan. And I had, you know, the only notion that I had was that I would, you know, get some great training and then go back to Japan. I love it there. And then, you know, in the early 90s was the full-on wave of Japanese chefs who were committed to coming to mostly France, but at that point. And they weren't just there for a couple of months. They would come and stay for a few years. Many of them shared small apartments. On Sundays when the restaurant was closed, we would all have a wine class, and it was led by a Japanese guy who was the sommelier at L'Arpège.
Wow.
And he would put posters all over the wall. Everyone would bring a bottle based on the theme of the class he was teaching, and he would, you know, he would talk for hours.
Wow.
And it was just, it was an amazing community. And because I was getting a little bit of a notion of the language, and at work there, when I was working in a restaurant called Jacques Kenya, there were 12 cooks altogether. Six were Japanese.
No.
And the head pastry chef was Japanese. And most of them didn't speak great French, nor did the head chef speak very good Japanese or English. And so, in a way, I think it saved my life several times. I was in over my head, for sure. And I was, you know, I was struggling to survive every day. It was a two Michelin star restaurant. It was a very serious place. And I was definitely, you know, the fact that the chef had said, get over here, Mike, tell them, you know, and he meant tell the Japanese guys this, and this. And I was like, okay, no problem. I think that's the only reason why I got to stick around for a little while.
But you really pressed the right button, like, you know, studied Japanese and met Shima, and then you were there. Just like,
you know, I was lucky. I was thinking about that. Like, if only we could establish those moments in life where you make those big decisions that end up, you know, becoming big curves in the road for you. I'd like to think that, you know, we as people get to, you know, have the ability to do that at any point in our lives. Mm. But yeah, that was one of those moments that those decisions really kind of determined the course that my life would take. And the only thing I can say is along the way, I met a lot of people that helped me. And, you know, when I tried to think of how I could ever repay them, the only thing that comes to mind is do it for someone else. Mm. And I've always wondered, you know, why the restaurant industry tends to create more roadblocks than it does avenues. And, I hope that, you know, through working that I could do something about that.
Mm, okay. And so then you moved back to the U.S. and worked as a line cook at Daniel, which, of course, has been one of the best French restaurants in the U.S., and then worked as a sous chef at New American Restaurant March. So was it... it's shocking to work in an American kitchen environment versus more structured or rigid, if you will.
Oh, yeah. It was a big change for me. And I realized that, you know, when I came to New York, I thought, well, that'll be my story is here's this, you know, kid who has experience working in French and Japanese kitchens. As soon as I got to New York, I started to admire David Boulay's style of cooking. And I was like, wow, okay, there, you know, this is really, this, there's a lot of room to work in this style. When I left the restaurant Danielle, I took my first sous chef job at the restaurant March. Mm. And I realized that, quickly I realized that it was for all the wrong reasons. Mm. Not that March wasn't a great place, but Chef Wayne Nish was, has Japanese heritage.
He's like a quarter Japanese.
He's half Japanese.
Right.
And so when I met Wayne, I thought the idea would be, okay, this is a way to cultivate a lot of the Japanese background that I have in my cooking. And, you know, I thought it would be, you know, he had a very present voice in kind of the evolution of American cooking, contemporary American cooking, a great, just an intuitive sense of how to listen to his own voice and combine ingredients in new and exciting ways. He really was a very inspirational chef. I realized that he wasn't really into, every time I would bring up references of Japanese cooking or French cooking, he was like, that's beside the point. Mm. And Wayne's take on cooking was really his iconoclastic approach to life. It was about, you know, really expressing something very personal about, you know, about being here in New York and about the way he grew up in a multicultural family. It was really an individualistic, you know, expression, which really wasn't all that different from the creativity that I experienced at Shima's place. Mm. I just didn't know what I was getting into. Ultimately, I worked there for 4 years and feel completely indebted to all the, you know, everything that I learned, all the things that I got to do while I was working there.
But that's
it was a surprise.
Right.
You know, life
But
life
in,
unfolds.
In other words, that's the way how you think of, you know, the new American cuisine, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be really like, you don't have a form or any models that to follow, and then you have to be strong and come up with your own style.
That's well, there's that, you know, the idea of style and kind of personal expression. And then also Wayne taught me this notion of, like, it's not really rocket science, but it's like, if you want to motivate people, they have to want to follow you. And you can't do that through, you know, rigid derogatory ways. Mm. You have to talk to people in a way that makes them feel valued and honored. And in a way, I kind of learned that in the kitchen, you can actually and have to really appeal to people on a personal level if you ever want to be able to share ideas and work together as a team. Mm. It seems quite simple, but, you know, for a cook who had never seen kind of laid back kitchen like that, it was brand new and it was eye opening. And I struggled first.
Okay. And then after you worked at March, you returned to Paris to work at Alain Passard at La Page and Pascal Balbo at La France. They were like forward-minded, innovative French kitchen. So
yeah, so I was lucky enough that when I was working at Danielle, I met Pascal, who came to cook in New York, and we hit it off. And you know, my time spent in their kitchens were just visiting. I was just an outsider coming to take a look. But you know, Pascal is just really one of the most energetic, positive, upbeat chefs I had ever met. And you know, he was very generous with his time and showed me around. And both when he was in charge of the kitchen at L'Arpège and then later at his own restaurant, L'Estrance. And so, you know, I've always been a fan of his, both his style, but more importantly, his the spirit he brings to the kitchen. Mm. Just this, he has a unquenchable thirst for discovering products and tinkering with new ways to handle them. He naturally, because he's so good at what he does, he figures out the kind of most direct way, or the best way, or the most simplistic way to handle them so as to really allow them to show off. Mm. And that's his style. It has amazed the world. I couldn't say anything more. Everyone already knows how spectacular he is. But it was a great eye-opening experience to see French food translated again through the eyes of, you know, he's a wanderer. He's a guy that translates flavors and ideas from around the world. Right. And I think that's, you know, one of the amazing parts of, you know, that's led to his success.
Right. Well, I've been to both restaurants. I have a sense of still something similar to what you cook at your restaurants too.
Well, that is beyond flattering. And, you know, I've been a fan of his, you know, for forever.
Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Mike's intense culinary training in Kyoto. So please stay with us.
This break song is entitled Relax, It's Just the End of the World by Techstar. You're listening to Japan Eats. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Michael Anthony, who's executive chef, partner of Gramercy Tavern, and executive chef and director of Untitled and Studio Cafe at Whitney Museum of American Art. And Mike received the James Beard Award, Best Chef New York City in 2012, and its national recognition, Outstanding Chef in 2015. So you came back to New York and joined Dunbarber at Blue Hill Stone Barns in Hudson Valley as executive chef in 2002. So do you think the experience at Blue Hill Stone Barns influenced your style of cooking now?
Well, it certainly was, you know, a fairy tale. And, you know, the natural beauty of that place, sure, has left a long-lasting image and many, many memories, yes.
Right. Okay. And so 4 years after you worked at Blue Hill Stone Barns, you became the executive chef at Gramercy Tavern. So how did it happen?
it was in a very roundabout way. I mean, long story short, I had set out to open my own restaurant, and I had a business plan and wanted to just cross all the T's and dot the I's, and I took it to Danny Meyer. Who else? I mean, who would be better to,
you mentor?
To just look over it? Well, I had met Danny along the way, and you know, had always admired his restaurants, and he was kind enough to help me and to look things over and give me lots of advice about, you know, about the plan that I had. And one thing led to another, and the conversation took a right-hand turn, and, you know, it seemed hardly possible that, you know, that would ever in my lifetime, you know, be a possibility. I hadn't really grown up dreaming about that, but, you know, when asked, I thought carefully about the idea of coming on at Gramercy, and it was ultimately an easy decision. It was, you know, both the easiest and the hardest job that I've ever stepped into, but it has been the most supportive and loving group of people, and the most fertile soil to grow in. So here we are 10 years later, and I am as deeply in love with the idea as I was, you know, the moment he asked.
Right. Okay. And under your leadership, Gramercy Tavern has earned a 3-star New York Times review in 2007 and James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurant in 2008. So how do you describe your style of cooking after, you know, absorbing so many great elements of French and American and Japanese cuisine?
Well, you know, first of all, I should say that, you know, those awards are all amazing thing to be a part of. It, you know, it's definitely work that was on the backs of so many people that came before me. That restaurant has a family tree unlike no other. And it's interesting when you meet people around town, you know, who at one point either work there now or at one point in their career work there, they all feel so deeply connected. And the people who worked there years ago feel as deep, if not, you know, deeper, more deeply connected as the people currently there. So it's an amazing group of people to work with. You know, the restaurant itself is an amazing platform to talk about contemporary American cooking because it was really conceived as the love child of Union Square Cafe and the warmth and the approachability of that restaurant, married with the excellence of Taïwan from Paris. Those were the kind of guiding lights behind the creation of that that restaurant. But when I got there, I tried to just, you know, in the spirit of the way I see food and remember the, you know, my favorite meals from around, from wherever I travel, I tried to simply think about how we could create a style of food that would appeal to people and really underline the moment that you're eating that meal and amplify that particular place. So the, you know, and I would go to places in Japan and in France, and I would meet people that were so proud of things that came from their, you know, their region and cooked them in a particular way and took their time to tell me about what was different about that than any other place. You know, it appealed to me, and I try to do the same through the platform of Gramercy Tavern. The idea that cooking with ingredients that are grown close to us, to home, thinking carefully about the changing season so that we're more aware of the world around us. And in fact, this is a little bit of a stretch, but really more in contact with the natural world. And I, for me, those are that was the connector in what has appealed to me as a chef, because now more than ever, it's fascinating. In the time that I've done this for a living, you know, it went from being a slightly marginal profession to being a job in which people frequently go to look for information. Chefs are asked to be the voice of so many different causes, whether it be in environmental, health, social justice, and so many more that are based on kind of that are connected to the restaurant world.
Right.
We have both this opportunity and responsibility of kind of paying attention and being aware. It's really a treat because in some ways it's almost like being a journalist. We're we are we're connected to so many different aspects of that impact aspects of life that impact the community that we are by far far from the experts in those fields, but enthusiastic contributors. And I think that if at Gramercy Tavern, what we really try to do is just play an active role in thoughtfully choosing the food that we serve, continuing to teach people something about our craft, and then doing it in a way that, you know, makes people understand implicitly that when they're on that team, they are needed. That their performance, their role, their lives matter in the process of that team performing really well. So anyway, I think we have a great place. It's a great place to work, and it's I'm really proud of the style of contemporary American food that we serve there. Not overly manipulated, focused on local ingredients, always trying to find a little something to surprise our guests.
Okay. Well, sounds like food at Gramercy Tavern is part of the nature. In a way.
Well, it's definitely with that thought in mind of look outside and see how, you know, the day feels. That should impact the way the meal is cooked and served.
Okay. And I think your cooking philosophy is summarized in your beautiful cookbook, V is for Vegetables, which came out in October last year. And what is the theme of the book?
Well, you know, I really wanted to encourage people at home to feel a sense of empowerment to cook more often at home. The idea of vegetables comes out of the way I like to eat. Vegetables are one of the easiest ways to open the dialogue about eating foods from here. Their color, shape, size, texture, you know, it's eye-catching. It's we have established a great distribution system. Many people are, you know, belong to either shop at the green market or belong to a CSA or have, you know, some excitement about visiting farms. Frequently I would see, you know, on posts, Facebook posts, people would like triumphantly hold something up out of their CSA basket and say like, what is this? And what do I do with it? And that is, you know, a common occurrence. I'm not making fun of anyone, but the book is really all about helping folks like that say, one, now I know what this is because I can name it. We did, we took Maura McAvoy, the photographer of the book, took beautiful pictures of the whole plants, leaves, stems, roots, intact.
Right.
So you could really see what it looks like when it, you know, when it first is harvested. And then we shot the book in natural light while I was cooking it and plating it. People could really get a sense of, not only am I following a recipe that works, but here's some guidance of figuring out like, okay, now I understand what he's talking about. He peeled it like this and cut it like that and then put it in a pan. You know,
right.
So there's some, when you shoot the process photos, there's some obvious steps that help people. It's not really holding their hands because I want for folks to, you know, learn how to cook intuitively, but it's pointing them in the right direction and saying, look, you don't need a specialist for this.
Right.
You can do this.
Yep. And I have the book and it's so easy and I feel like, oh, I can do this.
Cool.
So, all right. And then, oh, by the way, you have a couple of different Japanese vegetables and recipes. So,
The book was all about, you know, my first book was the Gramercy Tavern Cookbook, which was about the origin and the creation, the evolution of that restaurant, and all the people who have made it come to be such a special place. V is for Vegetables is about my personal take on food and cook from home. So naturally, a lot of Japanese techniques and ingredients found their way into that book because that's how I like to eat.
Right.
And so while I guess it may come across, you know, to sometimes my mom asks me, what are these ingredients and preparations like dashi? And she'll ask, what do I do with a daikon? And now I can just say, turn to page 50. But the idea may come across to some Americans who aren't familiar with those words as being a little exotic. But these days, I think that they're becoming quite well known for people who love food across this country. And now we've seen now more than ever that there is a connection, a cultural connection between the two countries through food that, you know, thanks to you and a lot of folks who have opened these doors, you know, we're really starting to run with it. I think that, you know, it wouldn't be a stretch to say that, you know, Japanese food is if not the most heavy influence on contemporary cooking. It's certainly one of the most important influences on contemporary American cooking. And that may not be through an overuse of technique or ingredients, but it's kind of in the spirit of things, that the natural approach, the kind of the normal and natural connection to the seasons around us, the idea of trying to refine dishes so that they're in the lightest form possible while still conveying flavor.
I should write down what you said, and I said flame it. And well, speaking of, so in 2008, I got a very lucky job to find two talented American chefs and accompany them to Kyoto, where they would train with the best kaiseki chefs for 10 days. And then you and David Chang or Momofuku and I went to Kyoto and spent time together. So do you want to talk about it?
Oh, well, let me just say thank you to begin with, because that was an extraordinary trip. You know, we were talking about it at the time, and it's still, you know, very true that had we lived and worked in Japan for 20 years, I don't think we would have had access like that to so many different restaurants, so many different producers and farms and, you know, cultural institutions. In 7 days, we took in a lot.
Right. Yeah. Actually, looking at the schedule, and we visited Kyoto Fish Market, Nishiki Food Market, Knife Craftsman, Sake Brewery, Kyoto Vegetable, that's like a national, we recognize 41 Kyoto dish, Kyoto vegetables, and Tofu Factory, Soba Factory, Kombu Factory, and we did tea ceremony, and more.
And we worked in restaurants.
Right.
We definitely misbehaved by staying out way too late and drinking too much. But, you know, I was thinking you mentioned the farm that we went to visit. Remember that? It was along the riverbed, and we got to pull up those akakabu,
yeah.
The red turnips. And now we see those growing here in New York. But I remember the flavor of those things. It was such a great experience. And the notion of kyoyasai, vegetables that are specific to the western, you know, Kansai region of Japan, that over years and years of, I guess, scrutiny between farmers and chefs, probably in the imperial court, but afterwards as well, you know, gave them the kind of dignity and classification of being recognized as special to that place. Wouldn't it be amazing if, you know, we were able to, in time, work with plant breeders and farmers to establish a group of vegetables that were recognized and known from, you know, from this area?
Right. Yeah, actually, I tried to plant some, and I think I sent the seeds to my friends in Arizona, and then they're able to grow some of them, so.
Well, I don't know if you remember, so there was, we went to visit the you know, the farm up in the mountains that it was a yuzu farm, but there was a sancho plant.
Right.
And I was talking about it because I was fascinated with the sancho peppercorns.
Right.
And they kind of grow in tandem sort of thing, one near the other. And the farmer pulled it up, roots and all, and said, yeah, take it, plant it. And I was like, that's such a great idea. And I wrapped it lovingly in a towel and then I was like, that's not a good idea. I'm never going to get back in the country like this. So I gave it to Shima, of all people, when I was passing through Tokyo, and she planted it.
Okay, right. Maybe next time.
Maybe it's growing strong.
Right. Okay, so what do you think you learned from the Kyoto experience?
Well, you know, first of all, it was the sense of generosity that the academy has for teaching about, you know, their heritage and their culture and their cooking. So on top of their already busy schedules of running their restaurants, and, you know, these are the top chefs in Japan, they were eager and open to share, you know, their restaurants, their lives, their producers, everything with us. And so that sense of when someone comes knocking on the door and expresses interest in what you're doing, you know, it it really it's really important to stop what you're doing and and pay attention to give them something, even if it's just a glimpse at what's going on. So that was that sense of that the sense of Japanese hospitality. And we also learned that it was quite curious when you had all these big chef guys in the teeny tiny ancient tea house to study the tea ceremony. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no one could fit into the slippers. And we were all kind of like, interesting way to spend an afternoon. Little did we know that Takahashi-san was serving
the chef
lunch from Kyote Restaurant, 15th generation chef,
right.
Served us, you know, the traditional tea ceremony. And like many chefs, he regularly practices the tea ceremony, which I guess can come across as curious for a Westerner. But we realized and learned that the heart of Japanese hospitality starts in that ceremony and in that, you know, the gestures that are involved in the ceremony. So it was an eye-opening experience. And you know, we were introduced to so many great flavors. You know, all of a sudden now, you know, you hear it's common for chefs to talk about, you know, koji, kuzu. These are, you know, items that a few years ago were kind of just arriving in, you know, American cooking and international cooking. Now they have arrived. And so this idea of building flavor using some of the kind of the building blocks of Japanese cooking is really, really interesting.
Mm. So how do you apply those, your takeaways to your own cooking at the Gramercy Tavern Untitled?
Well, you know, it's like I said, that I think that more than the techniques and ingredients themselves, it's the spirit of things of here's the direction that this dish should take. And it kind of, I would like to think that it appeals to especially Japanese diners because it's, you know, because of the way it's made, the freshness, the cleanness, the lightness, the refined quality, the closeness to nature, the, you know, even the way in which the ingredients fall. There's a little less symbolic plating in the way we cook. Not to mention that being an American chef, I find is kind of liberating. So while kaiseki cooking is true seasonal tasting menus, but it follows a very, very organized and in most cases an unchanging format.
Right.
Although chefs will add their own special touch. You know, for us it was even hard to recognize those special touches. They were so discreet. Whereas for us, seasonal cooking tends to be a new expression, almost a continual new expression of seasonality through the materials we use. So in some ways it's a guiding light. In other ways, I think what comes naturally to American chefs is this sense of freedom and ability to, you know, to explore and break rules in some cases when they make sense and to, you know, to kind of follow this ever-changing renewal of kind of innovative cooking.
I hope kaiseki chefs that you worked with are going to come to New York and then taste your dishes.
Well,
they may take something away from your dishes too.
There are no better chefs in the world, and they're masterful at what they do. And it's hard for us as Westerners to understand the concentration that it takes to continue to try to perfect one single style of cooking, and that's something that we have a hard time with. Our cooks get a little eager to move on to another station, you know, within months, and it's our job to continue to throw new challenges their way. But you know, if you think about that sense of you know, satisfaction in a job well done, that is part of really life in Japan, but especially in cooking.
I think, it reminds me almost like a martial arts.
Yeah, there's a real source of inspiration there. And, you know, while we pursue this idea of, you know, kind of the freedom in our cooking, it's important as cooks that we also apply discipline. So in both cases, I think, you know, that Japan gives us a great source of inspiration for moving things forward.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today, Mike. And please come back.
It was so great being here today.
Okay, so listeners, if you'd like to know more about Mike's restaurants, please visit thegramercytavern.com and untitled@whitney.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we recently launched a beautiful new website, so please visit our page. And today's show was made possible by Corinne, and our engineer is Liz Smith. And this is her last show with me at Heritage. And we'll miss Liz so much, but good luck on your new job, Liz. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and the Stitcher podcast. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.